He'd been at Jerusalem. He'd talked there, and they'd had the conference there in Acts 15. And up at Antioch, why, Peter went up there, and after the decision concerning Gentiles and so on, Peter mingled pretty freely with the Gentile believers. And they were getting along fine. And then some of the folks came up from Jerusalem, some of the Judaizers from James and others there. And Peter got scared, and he separated himself from the Gentiles and wouldn't have anything to do with them, gave them the cold shoulder. Now, a little mistake on his part, you see. This was the outward things. This was what his standing before his fellow men, the impression he was making on them was what he was concerned with. And so Paul took him to task. Now I want to read here what Paul had to say to Peter on that occasion. Now Paul did this in loving kindness, but nevertheless we are to reprove and rebuke. Paul did that. Now he loved Peter. He wasn't criticizing or anything like that as we think of and so on, but he was taking Peter aside and telling Peter a little of the truth. And I want you to notice it. I'm starting right in the midst of verse 14. And it's before all the people. Now, Peter, if thou, being a Jew, livest after the manner of Gentiles, and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews? All right, Peter, if it goes one way, it can go the other. Now, Peter, for a while, you've been living along with the Gentiles as if you were along with the Gentiles. Now, all at once, you've turned face, and you're wanting the Gentiles to do as Jews. How come? We, who are Jews by nature or by birth, and not sinners of the Gentiles, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. And Paul has made it very plain in his writings, you cannot receive justification, you cannot receive righteousness, and you cannot receive life by the works of the law. Those three things come by faith. So he's laying it out right here to Peter. He's giving him fundamental facts, telling Peter the facts of life. But if, while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners, if therefore Christ, is Christ therefore the minister of sin? Now the law, you see, condemns and make some sinners. Of course, we don't have that today. We're in a past dispensation. We're just getting some truth here from a past dispensation. But Paul says, but if while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners. Also found sinners. We're under the law. Is therefore the Christ a minister of sin? God forbid. Mm-mm. For if I build again the things which I destroyed, and he'd been preaching the gospel of the grace of God to these Gentiles, not to the Jews. Paul never preached the gospel of the grace of God to Jews. That would have been entirely out of place. He himself was subject to the law until his last trip to Jerusalem, the last of his five trips to Jerusalem. Remember, he's speaking to Gentile believers when he writes his epistles to the Galatians, and he's bringing this out for a real purpose. And so he says, if I build again the things which I destroyed, preaching the gospel of the grace of God, I make myself a transgressor of the law. Absolutely. For I, through the law, am dead to the law, that I might live unto God. The law slew him. He tells us that. Now, that's getting in deep. Now, verse 20. Peter, I have been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. I wonder what Peter was thinking. Now, he needed a review, you see. Peter needed a little review on what he already knew. And Paul gave it to him. We can forget, a lot of us, most of us, can forget once in a while. And we need a little something like that, a little review to show us. I do not frustrate the grace of God. Peter, I'm not going to put any of these Gentiles under the law. I wouldn't frustrate the grace of God, not for a minute. Remember when he was up to Jerusalem at that meeting there, he spoke about the somewhats of a Jerusalem. He says, they didn't tell me anything. At a conference. So they didn't tell me anything. He says, I told them all the wonderful works of God to the Gentiles without being circumcised and without coming under the law. I do not frustrate the grace of God. For if righteousness came by the law, well, then what is the use of Christ dying? That's what he's saying. Then Christ is dead in vain. Something to think about. Well, now, I want to take you on to another scripture. We review some of these things. Page 1277. This is Haggai, the first chapter, 5 to 7. Haggai, that's three stops back in the Old Testament. I'll help you to find it. 1277 in the Companion Bible. Haggai 1, 5 to 7. I'm going to take this and lift it right out of its context. There are a lot of scriptures can be done that if we're honest about it. And teach us a lesson today, because all scripture is inspired of God. God breathes and is profitable. And Haggai is a part of the scriptures. And therefore, it is God breathes and is profitable. Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Consider your ways. What are you doing? You have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages, earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus saith the Lord, consider your ways. Ever had that experience? Ever feel that way? That everything that you've done is in frustration and in vain? And that everything that you have done has been put in that bag with holes and it's gone? Ever feel that way? Come to the end of your rope? This goes right along somewhat with what Paul was telling Peter. And folks, the gist of the whole thing is this, and the secret of the whole thing is this. You have got to attend your own funeral. Paul says, I am crucified. I have been crucified with Christ. You've got to attend your own funeral. This ego of ours is such a big thing. We stumbled all over it. There will come a time in your life, if it hasn't already come, and you'll go through some of this. The Lord will bring you to it. And how you meet it is going to have a great bearing on the future. But there are times when we just come to the place that everything has gone through the bag with holes in it. And we come before the Lord and we say, Lord, I've tried everything. I've done all that I could do. You see, I have. It's all I. And it hasn't panned out. Everything has been disappointing, and I don't see the way out. And of course, the Lord has got it right where He wants us. That's what he does. He just fixes us so we come to that place. And then we just have to say, well, listen, Lord, there isn't a thing I can do. I can see that. I'm the end of my rope. So I'm just going to turn everything over to You. If You want me in the next 15 minutes, take me. I'm ready. Or if You're going to use me for something in the ministry or something like that, go ahead. Open up the way. I'm willing. And then's when you get the victory. Get rid of that self, crucified, dead. I say you have to attend your own funeral. That's hard. That's one of the toughest things to meet in life. But you're just going to keep on putting things into a bag with holes until you come to that place. I want to take you back to a man who went through some of that. Give you an example. A man who had it personally. That's page 682. That's Job 13. Job 13, verse 15. Now remember this, that Job never knew why. There's no record that Job ever knew why things happened to him as they did. There's no record that Job ever knew that there was a controversy between God and Satan about him. If it was known to him, it isn't told us in the Scriptures. And yet, suddenly, one day, the news came to Job that all of his sons and his daughters were dead. A whirlwind had come along and torn down the house in which they were meeting, and they were gone. And another messenger came in, and all of his livestock was gone. And there it was, within almost a few minutes, everything had come down about his ears as far as any of his possessions are concerned. Well, then there was another meeting of Jehovah and Satan. And Satan was told this time that he could touch Job's body, but not his life. Anything, but not his life. And Job ended up sitting out on an ash heap, scraping the putrefaction from the sores on his body with a piece of pottery, in agony, from the top of his head to the soles of his feet, suffering as much as a man nearly could suffer. Now, Job had been a very faithful man. He had made sacrifices for his sons and daughters, lest that they should get into some evil that he didn't know about. He had trained them carefully and all of that sort of thing, and here he is. Wouldn't anybody in that condition say, well, why did this have to happen to me? Wouldn't you? Why did this have to happen to me? Wealth all gone. Everything. Just one thing left, one miserable thing, his wife. And she says, Job, why don't you curse God and commit suicide? Have it over with. Wasn't she a wonderful helper? Of course, you can't blame her for not going out there and putting her arms around that old filthy fellow with all those sores and so on, and kissing him and so on, I expect. Oh, if she loved him, I think she would. You know, when a woman loves a man, she'll do anything for him. She really loves him, and the Bible says they're to love their husbands. But she failed in that. So he had a miserable helper there. And not only that, but he had three other miserable friends, if you call them that. And they did their best to convince Job that he had done something terrible, that all of this happened to him. You see, the question in his mind was, well, why did this have to happen to me? Well, over in chapter 13, verse 15, Job says this, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Well, is that a good or a bad attitude? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I go on over to chapter 19. You know, I think this is one of the high points in the Bible. This is something I've always liked. Chapter 19, verse 23. Long time ago, I used some colored pencils and shaded through some of this. Job is making a wish known here, a prayer. In spite of all of this misfortune, in spite of losing all of his property and his family, except his wife, and losing his health, and having three miserable friends hanging on his neck trying to tell him that he was all wrong, he says this, oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book. That they were graven with an iron pen and lead in the rock forever. Of course, now a lot of people will laugh about this and they say, well, they didn't write books back in that day. Well, you see, we aren't so sure about that now. It's just possible that the first two sections of Genesis were written on clay tablets by Adam himself. Just possible. And wouldn't it be a great surprise if the spade had turned those up someday? Because Moses carried them with him and they were to be incorporated in that book he was to write. 12 tablets cover the book of Genesis. And it's just there as plain as can be. You can see from the way that they used to write them and so on, and notice who the writers are, and they're all generations. First one is generations of heavens and earth, and so on. Yes, they wrote them, and books might be in clay, they might be on papyrus later on, or in the skins of beasts, and printed in a book. Printed, yes. I saw a sample the other day. Some woman has spent almost a lifetime of making beautiful printing like you see in the museums. And I've been in the British Museum and I've seen shelves and shelves of these ancient books with all of this gold leaf and lettering and so on. Beautiful stuff. You wonder how a person can do such perfect lettering and work on those. Bound in leather with all of the beautiful lettering on the outside. And you can go to one of these desks where one of them is opened up and there's glass over top of it and take a cloth off and look through the glass and look at the book. And they'll change those from every few days, but to keep a cloth over so that the light won't be getting in there to fade the book. But as you visit there, you can pull the cloth aside and look and then lay it back over it again. Job is wanting to have his words, whatever they are now. I don't know whether we haven't found out yet, see, what his words are. Now, it might be that he wants some words written about how that he's been treated, mistreated by God and by his wife, by his friends, and so on. Maybe that's a complaint that he wants to write. You suppose so? and graven with an iron pen and laid in the rock forever. In other words, back in that time, well, you folks maybe have seen a picture of the Behistun rock where it's writing on the side of it, and chisel it out and then fill it with lead and it stays there. Well, that Behistun rock has been there, what, about 4 millenniums? Maybe less. Now, he wants this, whatever he has to say. And then here's the message. Job's testimony. And you can't beat that yet today. For I know that my Redeemer liveth. On and on and on and on. And that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And Job didn't even have the Pentateuch. Job was saying this before Moses wrote. No doubt Moses took this book of Job and edited it, wrote a prelude to it, a postlude, if you want to call on that. I have no doubt about Moses had his finger in it. That's why I say Job himself never knew the first two chapters that Moses put in. He never knew the last of it either. Ideas why and what. Of course, he had the experience. There it is. I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. You know, this struck the fancy of the great musician Handel in his great musical work called The Messiah, or Yes. And it's been the subject of song and sermon and so on for years and years. And Job's wish was accomplished. These words have been written. They have been written many, many a time, over and over, as the Old Testament manuscripts are written by the scribes among the Jews. How many thousands upon thousands of those are written? And then there have been printed in books. Here it's printed in this book I have here, the Companion Bible. Every one of you probably has one, a book here as I printed in. And think of the millions upon millions of times that this has been printed, what he had to say. His testimony going out. And poor old Job, just a tribal chieftain, so never dreamed that his prayer would come true like this, did he? Well, you see, Job came to the place too. And he had to forget himself and give out his testimony. And verse 26, I'll give you a little different translation, suggested partly by the Companion Bible. After I shall awake, though this body be destroyed, yet out of my flesh, that is a new body, shall I see God. He knew the facts of resurrection. I say, if a man can go through what Job did, with all of the loss, all of the temptation or trial he went through, so on, give a testimony like that, what's the matter with us? What are we doing? Not enough of us have attended our own funeral yet. He says in verse 27, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another. It's I myself. Though my reins be consumed within me, which is just a figure of speech, though I go back to the dust. There is his testimony. Let's go back to the 14th chapter for just a second to look at another part of his testimony. Job is the only man in the Bible that I know of who prayed that he might go to hell. The only one. That's shocking to some folks, isn't it? Every man, woman, and child that has ever died since Adam has gone to hell, including the Lord himself. no escape from that. But there is an escape from hell, and the only one that's ever come out of it so far is the Lord Jesus Christ himself. First fruits of them that slept, the firstborn from among the dead, the beginning of the creation of God, the new creation, as we went over last night, yesterday, and so on. There is where the great hope is, and that's what Job was talking about. So I'm going to have a resurrection. I'll see him with my own eyes. People don't think it, you know, if we know there's anything about this new body and so on, to get over into 2 Corinthians 5. Job knew it all along. That Job was a wise fellow. You go through the book of Job and just see some of the things that Job knew. Well, for instance, just astronomy. More astronomical terms in the book of Job than you'll find anywhere, I think, in the Bible. In all the rest of the Bible. And if you are interested in that, just send to either to Phoenix, Arizona, to the BTRM, or to our friend down here, Mr. Tillinghast, and get my slides on the Maseroth, the signs of the zodiac, and the tape recording goes with it, 73 minutes, on the gospel and the stars. I've heard comments on that from all over England, down in New Zealand, Australia. People listen to that. No, it isn't much. I was only reviewing some things which I've learned over the years, and I wanted to put it down and get folks to look into that. That God had written his gospel in the stars so that man from the beginning would have no excuse for not knowing. Any man could look up at the sky if he had eyes. And if he didn't have eyes, somebody else could tell him. There it was written. And yet man turned that down, would have nothing to do with it, and brought out of that this terrible thing called astrology. And not only that, but even God gave Israel up to worship the host of heaven. And the ancients worshipped it. And the Tower of Babel was circled on top with the signs of the zodiac. And worshipped those figures or gave them other names and so on. And forgot the story of redemption entirely. Starting with the virgin and ending up with the lion, the tribe of Judah. Forgot it, put it aside. And Romans, the first chapter, give you some idea of that. How that they turned from the truth. Now Job, in chapter 14, verse 13, there's his prayer again. Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in hell. The grave, Sheol. You can translate hell anywhere in the Bible. When it's Sheol or Hades, you can translate it by the word grave. And you know grave damage to it. Of course, this is Gehenna. Well, then that's different. That's not the grave. That's the city dump where they burn trash. Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in the grave, that thou wouldst keep me secret until thy wrath be past. Well, how did Job know about God's wrath? He must have seen it in a star or somewhere. He must have seen Eridanus. He must have seen the flip over the heel over the serpent's head. All of those things. That thou wouldst appoint a set time for resurrection. And remember me. Takes you right to John 5, 28, 29. Remember? What's the connection between remember and sepulcher? A sepulcher is a remembrance place. And all that are in remembrance places are all in the memory of God will be raised someday. All that he remembers. Not those that he doesn't know and he forgets. Of course, now some people will say it this way. Well, now all that are in the graves, all that have been given a decent burial will be raised. Of course, the ancient Egyptians used to believe that sort of thing. If you didn't get a decent burial, why, you were gone. But if you got a decent burial, why, you're all right. And of course, they had a trial of the dead after they died. They had a trial. Had a hearing. And the witnesses come in and tell the good things the man did and the bad things he did. And finally the decision would be, well, he did more good than he did bad, so he gets embalmed and put away in a... Well, if he was a king, he might get put in a pyramid or something. But if not, they wrap him up in a sheet of sand and drop him in the sea. And he would never have another life. Now, Job's testimony here is this, and his prayer, that thou would appoint me a set time, a time of resurrection, and remember me. And so in that time, if God does that, as he says, God will say, Job, and up you come. For his sheep know his voice. They will hear him. If a man dies, shall he live again? Now here's his real testimony. If a man dies, shall he live again? That isn't the question they ask nowadays. They say, if a man's died, is he still living? How can you be dead and living at the same time, huh? If a man dies, shall he live again? He's already spoken about here, remembering him in a set time and so on in conduct of the resurrection. Now the question is, if a man dies, shall he live again? If any man dies, shall he live again? Well, as for me, all the days of my life, of my appointed time, will I wait till my change come. Change. Paul speaks something about resurrection and change too, doesn't he? Well, here Job knows them. And Paul said it was a mystery. Say, folks, I'm getting mixed up. How about you? Well, maybe we'll have to change our minds something about what mystery means sometimes, too. Of course, I think that mysterion, the Greek word for mystery, is simply something that is hidden, kept secret, until revealed to an initiate, somebody to whom is to be told. And if you put that on it, why, you won't have any trouble with its use anywhere in the Bible, even over in Daniel 2 or in Matthew 13, the mysteries of the kingdom. You can go through all of them, you won't have any trouble. And the mystery which was revealed to Paul, which had been hid from ages and generations. Then thou shalt call, there it is. And David, in the last verse of Psalm 17, when I shall awake, I shall be satisfied. Awake in his likeness, I shall be satisfied. David had a hope too. Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee. Now, Job has been dead for centuries already. Someday this is going to happen. It'll be considerably over 1,000 years yet from now. Considerably over as 1,000 years from now. Maybe 150 years more than that. Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee. Thou wilt have a desire to the work of thine hands. Is he talking about the old resurrection, or the old creature, or the new creature? I'll leave the question with you because I've overrun my time.
Now, a few years later, I would like to add just a bit to this, what God has to say about the deal of Job and his friends, and especially the start in the first chapter and also in the beginning of the second chapter, where God is speaking to Satan. And he said, as we find in Job 1:8, and the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? And then again in chapter 2, and the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright one, one that feareth God and escheweth evil, and still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause. And then going back into chapter 42, and we find the Lord speaking to one of the three miserable friends that Job had at that time. And so in 42 and verse 7, and it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. Therefore, take unto you now 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, and that you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, like my servant Job. These all give us a little more light, possibly, on what was going on. We can see the faithfulness of Job through all of his trials.